It's the last event this year by the Plaid Cymru History Society, and it's to note the 100th birthday of this dear party, and there have been a number of activities and several books, of course, and we discuss that now. It was only last night that I finished reading a very special book by Arwel Vittel, Glenn Griffith, on how Plaid Cymru was actually formed. It's a brilliant book. It's full of gossip and full of all sorts of things. But it ends up by saying something like this, that it's very difficult. I think it's in the final paragraph of the book, and it says, it's very difficult to imagine that a century ago how revolutionary the launching of Plaid Cymru was. Forming a party that believed in self-government and independence for Wales, and that's because Britishness was rife. And a century further on, here we are. We're still here. Things have moved much more slowly than a number of us would have wished. That's true. But it's also true that we've been up and down along the way. I'm not sure there's more to come, but isn't it great that almost at the end of our centenary of existence that we can celebrate that splendid, notable victory for Lindsay Whittle up in Caerphilly, an extremely important victory that I think prepares the party for the great challenge that lies ahead of us next year. And it sets us up perfectly, in my opinion. Anyway, this evening we'll be discussing one of the most important characters along this journey of ours. This boy here, David Ellis Thomas, the Lord David Ellis Thomas, knew him well, and we'll hear a lot about him, so I won't keep you, but very, very pleased to be able to work with him. He was the party president for some time, and he was someone I came to respect in the way that he trusted. He was a devolutionist instinctively. Perhaps, in some people's opinion, he was happy to devolve too much, but he was happy to ask people to do things and trust in them. But these two are here tonight, who knew him probably much better than I. And I'm very pleased that Aled Eirig has set about writing this book and got it this evening. So I can't say anything about the content, apart from the fact that there is a picture of me in there, somewhere in the middle. And as a member of the President's Committee in the Court in Llangadog, so wonderful. And then when I heard that we were going to have a history session in Llandaff to launch this book once again, it was mentioned that I would be able to talk with Aled about the book, but then I thought, nah, come on. There are far better people than me that could do this. And thankfully, independently, Aled Eirig thought exactly the same thing. We hadn't discussed it, but I think he knew what my opinion was. And so we're very pleased that we've been able to get our friend here, Vaughan Roderick, who knew him for many years. But some of us will have found ourselves almost as refugees over listening to Radio Wales, even though we're Welsh speaking, many of us. We listen to Radio Wales on a Sunday morning, and of course it's a wonderful programme that you hear. Sunday supplement, of course, and it's this friend here who shows us what's happening, and I'm very, very pleased, because I think Sunday supplement fills a really important gap with Vaughan Roderick. And over this next couple of hours, they'll be discussing this book, and by the end of it, we'll know far more about this very interesting character, Tavadellis Thomas. Well, good evening. Lynette was just saying now that Tavadellis Thomas would be very pleased that we were meeting, of course, a stone's throw away from the cathedral. He's a faithful member. But the location and the relationship is even closer, because if you look at the address, you're in the parish hall, but on the streets of the chapel, of course, Chapel Street. And of course, this was a Presbyterian chapel to begin with, before going under the ownership of the Anglican Church, following perhaps the same path as the person we're discussing this evening. Aled, in the beginning was the Word. So, let's start at the beginning. He was the son of the manse. To the big chapel. Can you explain to people what that means in terms of status and image for David and his family in the context of Llan Rwst in Gwynedd? Right, forgive me, I have a bit of a cough, but so perhaps I'll be coughing too much tonight, so apologies in advance, but one of the things about David was his upbringing in Llan Rwst specifically. His father was a minister with the Presbyterians, and he was a minister in the biggest chapel in Llan Rwst, not only in terms of size but also status. And status was a big thing, certainly for the deacons of Seon in Llan Rwst, and I think also for members of the chapel. And W.E. Thomas was a very interesting man, his father, and he'd been in university in Bangor and was trained as a teacher to begin with, but then he gave that up after qualifying to become a minister. But in the college in Bangor, he got a name for himself as a very good actor, a brilliant performer. And one of the most interesting things about him, perhaps, was his upbringing. And his father worked in the slate industry in Blaenau-Ffestiniog, and a crisis, of course, happened in the slate industry pre-First World War, and they moved down to the Tumble in, and he lived there for 7 or 8 years before going to university, and that's when he came across the ILP, the Independent Labour Party. He attended classes for adult education, and amongst the tutors was S.O. Davis, who many of you will remember S.O. as a Member of Parliament for Merthyr. But at the time, he was an inspiring man, and possibly the guy who's most on the left within a stone's throw. And I think for W.E., even though he didn't talk much about his original politics, he had some sort of warmth towards the ILP, but was also a nationalist. And one of his big friends was Elwyn Roberts, who became the General Secretary of Plaid Cymru, and they did a lot together. And when the Eisteddfod came to Llan Rwst in 1951, Elwyn was the organiser, and David's father was one of the main local organisers. So Seon as a chapel was very notable for the standard of the presentations made by the chapel. The organ was the most modern organs of any chapel in Wales, certainly in that period. And David and his sister Elin were, you know, trained on the harp and violin, and were worked quite hard by their mother to compete and win in the Eisteddfods and so on. And David became a very, very able public speaker. Even before reaching college, he was known as a good public speaker. But I think in the chapel, plenty of deacons were Freemasons and lawyers or teachers, accountants. So they were of some strata socially that was higher and more ambitious than any other chapel in the midst. But this is interesting. To a degree, one has to read between the lines in the book, because I suspect one has to read between the lines about the family history, but one knows that Elin and her family cooperated with this book, and we'll see the reason for that soon. But what was interesting was that you had the father, the mother, two children, but also the aunt, the sister of the minister. And the description you give of her, is it fair to say that she was treated almost more as of a maid than as a slave, than as a sister, sorry. More as a maid than as a sister. Yes, well, that's true. Before they got married, she looked after the home on behalf of W.E. And I think she was a bit younger than W.E. and that she'd been she'd lost her love in the First World War, and that really affected her, and she's suffered from depression ever since. So W.E., on one element, he was looking after her, but also for the children, she was particularly dear, and she spent most of the time with the children in the home, while Aedlis, David's mother, and Elin's mother, was working, going around. You see, I read this and it reminded me, I don't know how many of you actually read the book yet, or have you read Gwyneth Lewis's book, where she hated the fact that her mother pushed her all the time and even interfered in her written work, adding and changing things to her poems. Aedlis kind of treated David in the same way, didn't she? Yes. What's interesting is how the two children reacted to the pressures, and I think there was a lot of pressure on the children in those early days. And Elin rebelled quite openly at the age of 14, 15, just refused to do things. David was a bit cleverer. He dealt with the situation in a slightly more diplomatic way. But the relationship then between Elin and the mother was a difficult one, yeah, in truth. Well, let's move on to the young David Ellis Thomas before he went into politics. Conwy in 1970 first is where he stood, before maybe on it in 74. But the path, the political path, was not an inevitable one, no. There were academic opportunities, and also there's another possibility. I can let you in on a story here. For the first time I met David Ellis Thomas, I would have been about 10 years old, and David was presenting a programme on the BBC called Bored, B-O-D, not B-O-R-E-D, Bored as in existing, to exist. It was a religious program that was meant to be relevant to young people who were turning their backs on chapels at the time. So he was sat there in his floral tie and jacket, and there'd be pop singers and sketches like this, trying to emulate what he was saying, and I was playing the part of in a sketch where I had to pretend that I was trying to get a train set to work, and the train refused to work, and it refused, and David then walks over with a can of Castrol in his hand and says, yeah, you have to oil the tracks like this, like this. Try it now. And of course the train goes. I think it had just been switched on, that was happening. And then David says, yes, you have to oil the tracks. And you know, it's the Holy Ghost that oils the tracks of faith. So I'll always forget that sentence. Always remember that sentence now. Unforgettable. And so there were opportunities there. You know, it wasn't inevitable for him to go into a career in politics. It could have gone to broadcasting, academic life, as opposed to a professional politician. Yeah. And after college, he had a job in Harlech College in 1970, and he loved his experience there. And it's very important for him to get to know Meirionnydd that way. But in November 73, he got a job in Bangor University, and Emyr Humphreys had been teaching drama in the English department there, and he had left to get a full-time job, and David then took his post. But that was in the November. He was already a candidate in Meirionnydd for Plaid Cymru then. He took ill at Christmas time, started in January, and then the election was announced at the end of February, so he'd barely been in post and seen there at all. But it does also suggest that he had seen his future as an academic. And I think one of the things in his life was that academic background, because his great interest was criticising literature, and he did it particularly well and was very bright. And I think that was at the root of the fact that he'd applied for the post in Bangor in the first place. If you think of the Meirionnydd constituency and all those, you know, twists and turns, Gwynfor stood there before getting elected. Meirionnydd is like, you know, the seat of the president. Wigleave stood there in 1970 and moved to Caernarfon in 74. Is that a reflection, perhaps, that Plaid Cymru people thought there was a much better chance of winning in Meirionnydd than anywhere else? No, I don't think so. Because what happened was one of the most controversial questions, Rio Tinto Zinc, if you remember them, were mining for copper in Cwm Hermon, and the problem for David Wigley as a candidate was that his father-in-law was the land agent on behalf of RTZ as they were analysing the land. So David Wigley was in an impossible situation. If he'd have stayed, he'd have been accused by one side or the other of failing to be objective. And so he and David discussed in 72-73 what they should do, and they agreed between them that Wigley should stand at Caernarfon, because Robin Lewis, the former candidate, had said that he wouldn't be standing again. And then David Hill would then stand in Meirionnydd. So David Hill had already decided that he didn't want to stand in Conwy, because he disagreed with the constituency committee with regards to industrial development, and he'd come out in favour of RTZ development as a way of creating jobs there. So that was the background. And I think they were hopeful, of course, and optimistic, but they weren't totally convinced. I'm sure Tawdil wasn't, anyway. So they were going to win 74. So when they did win, it was a shock. There's so much to discuss. Because there was a second election in 74, and Labour got a tiny majority that then disappeared soon after. Some of you may remember the Lib-Lab Pact. The three of them who were elected in October, of course, two in February, were very influential. And what's interesting for me is looking at what's happened since devolution. The requirements on Plaid Cymru members, on the whole, of the Labour government are things that weren't... the requirements made on Labour by Plaid Cymru were not things that they would massively oppose. I mean, who in Labour would refuse compensation for slate workers? And it does remind me of the kind of men we got back in the coalition in 2007, in the coalition between Labour, agreement between Plaid and Labour in the current session. They're the kind of things that Labour would have wanted to see anyway, and I think that's been a theme that started 50 years ago now. But it's been quite a consistent theme in the history of the party in terms of not asking Labour to give them things that they couldn't give, but to give them things that would be popular. Is that a fair thing to say? Well, I think it's fair in terms of Dafydd Hill and Wigley, but not so much of Gwynfor. There were a group of three, but they had a lot of discussions about whether they would support a Labour government or not, and on the whole, they were very supportive, apart from one or two, and right until the end, and differently the SNP. But I think if Gwynfor had his way, they would have been more aggressive and critical of Labour. And I think Wigley even was more supportive than Gwynfor, and partially because of the political situation in Carmarthen compared to Arfon and Meirionnydd. And then everything came to a head, of course, with the decision to support Labour in the motion of no confidence in 1979. And Wigley remembers Gwynfor saying in that meeting, if they supported Labour, Gwynfor would be bound to lose his seat, and that is, of course, what happened. Even though in the long term, it was the SNP that paid the price for voting against the Labour government. So let's talk about personal life. He had a young family, and one of the most incredible stories in the book, I think, it's amazing, it's difficult to imagine, but David wanted to move his wife and children to live with him in London. But the constituency committee insisted that she should appear in front of the committee to get their permission in order to move with her husband. Can you? I know it's incredible to believe it that now, but so could you let us in on that marriage? I mean, yes, it failed in the end, but it was a very close one. Yes, they met at university. Ellen was a music teacher. Music student. And they married in 1970. They had three children. through boys. And of course, the difficulty was Dafydd was elected in February, March 74, and apart from the Bangonisdi business, Ellen had had her first baby, Roland, about 2 weeks, 3 weeks before then, and in the same month, Annie, the favourite auntie, died. So you can imagine the major changes that were happening in their lives. And I think also he was the youngest of all the MPs. He was the baby of the house in 74, 27 years old. And I think the pressures, personally, I would have thought, were quite massive, were immense. There was expectation on him not only to be an MP with Dafydd Wigley as a constituency MP, but also represent Plaid Cymru nationally. And I think certainly he was working 6 days a week, and on the seventh day he'd spend all his time on the phone with either journalists or someone from the Labour Party asking which way they were going to be voting, and so on. And I think the pressures on him were immense. Well, Plaid Cymru asking too much of him, because I think Gwynfor here, Gwynfor was like some version of Williams Pantycelyn with a car. You know, he was on the road all the time. Every branch wanted Gwynfor to come and open this or give a speech. And the expectation of ordinary members of Plaid Cymru, of their leaders, were just unreasonable and unfair, really. Well, I'd say so, but you're going back to a situation in its historic context, and Gwynfor had been an MP before, and the change was immense for the party. It was a really exciting period for them, and the potential in the 70s was that devolution was going to happen. So there was a lot of pressure on MPs, and of course they were very committed and gave of their time, and they paid the price over a period of years. And I think by the end of the 80s, certainly the two Dafydds had basically run out of breath with all the work that they'd had to do. And you referred there to people who thought the devolution was coming, and then the trauma of the 1979 referendum, and different parts of the national movement responding to it in different ways. I would argue that maybe on Glyndŵr was a quite an obvious response to the 79 referendum, but I don't know who they are. Gwynfor responded, of course, with his threat to hunger strike, something that Dafydd hated. But what Dafydd perhaps did was start to embrace ideas of the new left, as he called Gramsci and people like that. So talk to us a little bit about perhaps why he hated the fast so much, the threat to fast and to death, and also the development, that intellectual development, with him living in London, starting to move in circles that were Corbynistic, we'd say today. Yeah, but I think in the 70s, they would already consider themselves as socialists, and I think the inspiration for Dafydd would have been not Saunders or Marx, but Tom Ellis more than anybody else, one of his predecessors in Meirionnydd, a liberal of course, but in favour of devolution, self-government, one of the founders of Cymru Fydd, called himself a socialist, and he saw that he was in that sort of lineage of Tom Ellis, but I think in the 70s there was a need for the party to place itself somewhere on the left-right spectrum where a lot of people in the party disagreed, but he thought in terms of ensuring that there'd be a wider appeal to the party in Wales, that it needed to happen. And so that was one of the reasons why people took to him in the House of Commons. People in the Labour Party saw that he had common ground, I suppose, like-minded spirit, and he became friends with some of the Labour members, to the point that some people thought, oh, he's going to leave the party and defect to the Labour Party. But of course, that was never going to happen. But he was very good at working not just with Labour, but other parties too. And I think what's striking about devolution in 79 is that Dafydd was a lot less demoralised by the result than the majority of people. You know, John Davies talks about it as almost a death in the family. Dafydd was just saying, well, if we can't explain to people what the advantages of devolution are, well, we deserve what you get, you know. So what he felt was the idea of self-government should be extended and the party should develop the idea. So if you remember, after 79, one of the most striking things were the threats to the Shotton Works and so on, and the party started working with the trade unions for the first time, trying to oppose what Thatcher was doing, and that was very effective indeed, and that's why Dafydd was so angry. And Wigley wasn't actually very happy either with the Gwynfor's decision to go on a fast over a Welsh Channel, because Dafydd felt that it took the party back to where it was in terms of being a cultural Welsh language movement, where in truth what the party had been trying to do since the 60s was modernise and be a political party, a democratic political party, with a broad appeal. It's interesting that during this period, you mentioned the race between Dafydd Wigley and Dafydd Ellis Thomas, but there was an image that Dafydd Ellis, well, amongst certain members of the party, as some sort of popinjay, as some man who wore the Armani suits and the man who liked to live on the fat of the land in London. There is an element of truth in that, isn't there? You know, I do recall, and I'm sure you all remember, after the marriage failed, one of Dafydd's partners was a woman called Marjorie Thompson, who came from the United States, was very prominent in CND, and was very active during the Green and the Common period, was very important. And I remember going to an event in Gales Wine Bar, which is a wine bar by the Thames. A very interesting place indeed, if I may say so. And if I remember rightly, it was Carl Davis's birthday at 40, and Dafydd turned up in a suit, a white suit, an Armani white suit, and he and Marjorie had had an argument. She took the biggest glass of red wine possible and just threw it all over him. So he was in a place in his life where he wasn't quite sure where he was going. Is that fair to say? No. Well, okay. Perhaps. for a period, a certain time, and specifically in the 80s. But it's too easy to generalise, and it's too easy to see Dafydd in those terms. But I think it's a bit misleading. And he played down how serious he was as a politician, how good he was as a politician. Okay, he loved clothes, but that goes back to his college days, because he was very fortunate to win two scholarships to go to college, and also was also paid a lot of money by about three aunties from Newcastle Emily, who happened not to have any children, had quite a lot of money to spend, so they spent it on him and supported him in college. And I think one of the things that Dafydd loved about clothes was using clothes in the context of whatever he was doing at the time. So he had appropriate clothing for going to the farmer's mart, yeah? Dressed as the country squire, yes, exactly. And if he was on the way to meet the sailing clothes of Aberdovey, he would be dressed like them. He was very aware. And that, he enjoyed that aspect of it. I just want to quote out of the book. By the way, it's a great book, very readable. One story where he discusses the Armani books, he says, yes, I buy Armani clothes, but only in the sales. So, yeah, there are several stories. So that decision then, to step back. And I think sometimes we think of Dafydd Hill as a member of parliament, who then went to the Senate, but there was a period in the middle where he went to the language board. And you talked about Dafydd's ability to work with other people. And it wasn't just the party of the left, was it? You know, that friendship between him and Wyn Roberts as the Secretary for Wales, that, yeah, both sons of Presbyterian ministers, of course, who happened to be friends, yeah. That led, of course, to the language board. Yeah, yeah. And I think that one of the things that is interesting in that period is that by 89, Dafydd Wigley, as well as Dafydd Hill, had come to the conclusion that they just had enough. You know, Dafydd Wigley had been offered several posts: chief executive of Gwynedd, chief executive of WTA, another post running a humanitarian organisation in London. And Dafydd had started to think about going back to academia. And I think they'd reached a point after 15 years where I'm sure they were exhausted, to tell the truth, and so much pressure placed upon them. But I think also in that period, Dafydd was looking at doing things, different things, going back to do media stuff and so on. And what happens, of course, is that Wyn Roberts persuaded the Tories that there was a need to establish the Welsh Language Board, a statutory one. And in doing so, what Wyn Roberts believed was that whoever the chair would be, it would be very useful for them in the House of Lords in order to give status to the board. And at the time, if you remember, we had all these quangos, hundreds of them, running public life in Wales. And he thought that they needed someone in the House of Lords that would reflect the kind of status that other quangos had across Britain. And so that's where the starting point was for Wyn. And then I think they had Dafydd had lunch with Emlyn Hooson, the Liberal, in the January or February before the 92 election. And Emran Hussein said, why don't you come to the House of Lords? And David said, I mean, it hadn't struck his mind until then. But then he received a phone call from Wynne within a week, 2 weeks, saying, have you thought about the language board, and would you be interested in House of Lords? And David thought, oh yeah, something's happening, you sensed a plot here. And I think that Wynne had said before the 92 election, because nobody knew who'd win, a lot of people thought Neil Kinnock would win in 92. But I think there was a supposition from Wynne that if they did win, that David would be offered a place in the House of Lords and a chair, and that's what happened. Something that's of interest, it was very controversial within the party to accept a seat in the House of Lords. I remember David being selected as David Williams here, being selected as a prospective candidate for the House of Lords. But there was a love-hate relationship between David and people in Plaid Cymru. He didn't feel the need to explain. He just did. What happened was this. David Wheatley, as leader of the party, had already suggested someone from the party to go to the House of Lords, even though it was against party policy. Right? And then David never spoke to anyone from the party because he knew that it was party policy to refuse a seat in the House of Lords. So he didn't see the point. And I think on the Saturday, we were talking about this, the Saturday after the election, David got a phone call from Downing Street saying, oh yeah, you know, you get a representative now in the House of Lords. And David really thought they were talking about David, but David Wheatley agreed in the end. But I think there was a little bit of hypocrisy, may be too strong a word, but I think there was a lot of nonsense being spoken about it amongst elected members, from I say, of the party, because there were some people very critical of David for what he did. What's interesting is that he never lost the support of the party in his constituency, and I see that as very striking, that when he chose to go back into politics to the National Assembly, and then at the end of his career, when everybody knew he was going to leave the party and go independent, people still supported him. I think the party was in a very difficult position. There was a big concern that David would leave, and in the end, the party centrally agreed to support the constituency locally and therefore support David with the nomination. And I believe that if the party hadn't done that, there would have been a massive fight in Mid Yorkshire that would have split the party. And I'm sure David would have won, but it would have damaged the party in Mid Yorkshire. But I think the loyalty of the party in the constituency to him was of an interesting one. In looking at the early years of the Assembly, you know, by now, We just accept the Senate as part of everyday life, but the assembly was wobbling a lot in the early days. Some people say that they expected it to fail at the time. You know, that the settlement was insufficient, it was unclear. Everything had been designed by the architect of devolution, Ron Davis, to win the referendum. And of course it was won by a whisker. But the result was a settlement that didn't do much. It didn't make much sense. And the person that had to try and make that settlement work more than anyone was David Ellis Thomas. And the way that he very cleverly ensured Alan Michael's departure and Roger Morgan's elevation, and the way that he used the royal family to pretend that this body had a status and gravitas that it actually didn't have. That's one way of putting it. What I would say is, as you suggest, I think the first 2 years were of the experience of creating devolution and the Senate and the Assembly was so meant that the institution was so frail that as one person recently said, that he thought that it was quite possible that the Assembly would have failed during that period. But it also shows explains why David was so aggressive to civil servants at this time. He knew for a fact that the opinions of the civil service at the highest level was that this wouldn't last more than 2 years, and he was absolutely convinced that he had to make it work. And I'd say about David, amongst his greatest successes was to ensure the continuity and continuation of the Senate, and indeed its strengthening in terms of differentiating responsibilities between the assembly and the government of the assembly. And he and Roger Morgan worked together to make sure that that happened, and happened gradually, and that was utterly essential. But I'd also say that one of his greatest successes was to ensure the creation of that building, because were it not for David and one or two others, Labour ministers maybe, these things wouldn't have happened. Because Roger Morgan didn't want to see it happen. He had no confidence in the idea at all. That relationship is an interesting one, isn't it? Between Roger and David. Because in several meanings, the similar characters, interesting, learned people, maybe not in clothing style, but the relationship there was a very spiky one too. Oh, do you want to tell us more? Well, I mean, I remember when Rodri, especially when he came in to the BBC office in Crickham, and if you said something about David, there'd be a bit of a rolling of the eyes going on, I would say. It may be a quarrel about what Glyn Davis said about Bog on Stilts, which was Roger Morgan's plans to have the chamber. But whatever the quarrels, the relationship was not as friendly as one would have expected it to be, considering their interests were so similar, and their reading materials would have been very similar. Well, David always said that he didn't have to talk very often to Roger, because he understood exactly where Roger was coming from, and he understood him, and I think he's right. But I do think that what they had in common, it was true, and it's true about Charles Wigley and one or two others, was the fact that they'd been in the Senate, the Parliament in London rather, and that they understood how Parliaments worked and why it wasn't working. And I think they felt very strongly about that and creating the assembly of something viable that would work practically. And he got on really well with Rodri on the whole. They did fall out, and that includes Rodri defending civil servants against Dafydd when Dafydd was attacking them. But I think Rodri had to do that, in truth, because, you know, it would have been seen as unfair that politicians were attacking civil servants. But I think they understood each other, to tell you the truth. They came to that. One of the interesting elements was how nervous they both were with regards to the 2011 referendum and what happened between 2007 and 2011. They were very cautious and very concerned because obviously they'd have the 1979 experience. But the younger members, like Corryn Jones and Rhiannon in the party, they didn't see what the problem was. Yeah. So we move on to the final period as the deputy first minister of... the deputy minister in the Labour government. If you'd say... what job in government would be appropriate for Dafydd Hill? It would have been that exact job, wouldn't it? And one knows if you talk to people in the arts and his depth of understanding of the area, there was no one like him who'd ever been before or since, to be true. But he failed in several ways because of the paucity of money from the M4 and therefore to win the battles on additional funding that he was trying to win. And leaving the arts as they are in Wales today in a little bit of a pickle, under pressure. Was he a success or a failure, or a bit of both, in that post? A bit of both. Certainly that was the job he wanted, and I think people suggested that he should have asked for something more ambitious, like, you know, education or something. But no, that was his delight. And I think you have to remember that COVID came 2.5 years into his period, and so he spent the second half of his period trying to defend the arts from the impact of COVID and so on. And so he did some key things, funding and sustaining elements of the arts. He also prevented some developments, interesting developments in terms of combining bodies that would have weakened them in the end. And he went against the policy of the previous minister. So I think on the whole he'd been very effective, and there was a lot of praise for him from the arts sector especially, but as you suggest, I think the arts generally suffered over the last 10 years, and not because I think the Welsh Government wants to reduce the importance of the arts, but that there were financial pressures consistently that have hurt the situation and have made things very difficult. So to summarise, and we'll open this up for questions from the floor, if we look at Welsh politics over the last 50 years, from 74 to 95. Where does David Ollis, 74 to 2025, where does David Ollis Thomas stand as a figure of importance compared not just with Plaid Cymru people, but Labour Party people as well? And I think we can, we don't have to consider the Lib Dems, it's quite easy to do. Where does he stand? I mean, certainly he's an important figure, but he's a complex figure, yes? Not a person that's easy to understand. Well, that's why you've got to read the book, isn't it? But, you know, David Wigley is quite an easy person to understand. Doesn't change much throughout the years. And we've got David Hill, who, son of a minister, who is an academic, who's, we've got the MP, we've got the periods when he left, then we've got the period where he liked to live in a very luxurious house, and we're renting, by the way. Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not sure that he's wearing plus fours, but he certainly did wear a lot of tweed. So how did we see him? Was he a weathercock? Or was there a thread, a golden thread, that ran through everything? I think if you look at him seriously, I think it's quite easy to be distracted by what was he wearing or whatever. His significance as one of the three members of the party of Plaid Cymru in the 70s, his contribution to the national movement generally in the 80s, in his presidency and the miners' strike, and the fact that he created alliances and opportunities to forge partnerships and alliances that was so significant in the devolution campaign. And that's how it started, with people working together cross-party, and it was of key importance. And I think his work as Llywydd was unique and of key importance. And I've already mentioned, of course, why he was important in those roles. So I think I would place him in the top three or four people as an impact politician, and the top three or four of any Welsh politician. I'd say he and Rodri certainly. I just don't know who else you'd put in there, in those top five. But I think that he's on that level, yeah. And that what he achieved was a very special legacy, and we're still seeing how it's developing over now and the next few years. Well, that's just a taster of the book you've had there, and I'm sure you'd like to thank Aled for sharing some of his stories with you tonight. And perhaps we'll have an opportunity now for you to ask any questions or make any comments that you might have. Well, firstly, thank you both for the presentation, and congratulations, Aled, on writing this book. Is there any story you'd like to tell us tonight that never made it to the pages of the book? Any story at all? Actually, we mentioned at the beginning, and we didn't explain, the fact that Davy's sister and her family did not collaborate with the writing of the book. It was a brief story. Why? They didn't see eye to eye. Ellen and David. So often one of the person, the children, did not want to be concerned with it. But there was an interesting story. The one I was trying to get you to tell was the poem that she'd written. Oh, that's right. Well, I mentioned January 74. There were so many things happening in David's life. And of course, Auntie Annie died in January as well. Now, she'd been suffering from depression, especially after David's father died in 69. She was in and out of Denby Hospital, and died in Denby Hospital, actually. Now, in January, February, Elin wrote a piece of prose and sent it to the Earth Eisteddfod that year in Covent Bay. And this was the first time the prose medal had been offered in the Eisteddfod. And she won. And she was talking about her auntie. And when their mother heard about the fact that she'd written and sent this prose in without even talking about winning it, she went nuts. And why? Because it would bring the family to disrepute. And she insisted that Elin did not submit the final version of the piece to the Eisteddfod for it to be published. And it was never published. And I've never seen that piece of prose. And I don't even know if it still exists. But that showed you the depth of ill feeling between the mother and Elin. And the irony was that after that, the mother gradually became more ill, moved to Bala to be closer to Elin, where she lived in Llanuwchllyn, and Elin was the one who had to deal with her mother in her final days. Any other question? Mr. Keith Bush. I'm under some disadvantage because I haven't read your book yet, Alan. Excellent. But obviously, you treat the subject very deeply, but of course, what, in your opinion, well, what was unique about Douglas Thomas as the president of the National Assembly stroke Senate was the fact that he did that job for 12 years and then played a key role, as you say, in moving from a glorified county council to a proper national body. And so I'm sure there's plenty of history, a story about that decision not to follow the pattern adopted, for example, with the Scottish Parliament, where the Llywydd is a fairly neutral chair who just chairs debates and so on, and instead adopted some sort of continental pattern of being an actual leader, head of the organisation, the institution. Well, since you are you, Keith, it may not surprise you that the level of discussion and constitutional attitude of David towards that particular post, I think what was interesting was contrasting what David said about his experience in the house looked and what he wanted to create anew, which was to get rid of those traditions and take the new fresh look at how the assembly should be run. And he was very aware of that. And there are elements that I haven't mentioned in terms of how of key importance David was in terms of ensuring the Welsh language was central to what the assembly did, and aspects, attitudes towards bilingualism and encouragement of people to use the Welsh language. And he, more than anyone else, used the Welsh language on a daily basis as a matter of necessity, almost. And he named the Senedd the Senedd rather than Parliament, without any permission or support from anyone. He just went ahead and did it. And of course was judged by people like Leighton Andrews and others, and used Welsh names for every part of the Senedd building. Little things like that. He saw that the creation of the building and the forming of the Welsh language as part of that as a key part of, well, perhaps it would be too much to say creating a nation, but the idea of one. And that was a really important thing. And I would say, I mean, I can't think of anyone, in truth, of anyone else, apart from maybe David Weekly, who would have been the same, as just as strong and true to ensuring that the nature of the assembly would be different to the parliamentary tradition. But it's a brilliant question, and in comparing with Scotland is a very interesting point. Thank you. Anybody else? Well, I think you answered all the questions.
Great.
There's one thing we haven't talked about. The book is for sale here, yeah. But it's impossible if you're a journalist of Aled and my age not to mention the miners' strike in 1984-5. And I think it's fair to say that the miners' strike, a notable event in the history of Wales, was also a notable event in the history of Plaid Cymru too. And that's because of David Ellis Thomas. Perhaps you could elaborate, but it was one of the things I wanted to ask you. Yes, I think that the leadership of David in that period was of key importance. Referred to it already, you see the same people supporting the miners' strike, and people around them, local groups, and they were the same people who developed to be campaigners in favour of devolution in 97, and the same people that cooperated in 85, who came together not only for devolution but also to ensure that the assembly worked and got further powers. That, I think, is significant over a very long period of time. You know, 15 years or more. Well, people didn't realise that he'd done. But I think that David also got so much more credibility to the party as well, as a party that was in favour and supporting the people generally in Wales, and appealed to part of an audience there, that all the electorate, that perhaps would not have supported Plaid usually. And I think David was disappointed after the strike that they hadn't seen more of an increase in support for the party. But what they did see was an increase in maybe a friendliness and a fondness for the party and a willingness to work with it. And you come to the end of the '80s where the party develops policies that are pushing a parliament for Wales. And I think that was a very important thing, that were it not for David, that might not have happened. Because David, during that year, was very critical of elements in the party who were still talking about how important the water campaign was in a period when half of Wales was under siege, you know, from the police and flying pickets and so on. And if the party had gone to that direction, then I think it would have appeared very unprofessional. So, footnote from that period, but there's an awful lot more. Not a question, but just a memory. I remember during the miners' strike, as they were broadcasting a Plaid Cymru conference, and David was present at the time, yes, 84, and I recall him on the stage wearing one of his ties. He took the tie off and wore the NUM tie. Very striking. That's what I remember. Yeah, I have a lot of those ties still. You went to NUM conferences and everybody would wear a pullover and with a tie outside the pullover so that you could see where they were from. Well, thank you, Arcomt, and thank you all for coming, and I hope you've enjoyed yourselves. Aled hopes you're going to buy his book. Hey, Christmas is coming around. And I do recall one story. David Wigley released the first volume of his autobiography. Three altogether. Dal Atty, I think it was about five altogether. But there was one Plaid Cymru branch secretary in Arfon who'd received seven copies as Christmas presents. So be aware, be careful, but thank you all very much for coming, and thank you, Aled. Well, huge thanks. Really grateful for the opportunity, but heroes tonight, Aled and Vaughan. You've been, Aled, very brave for fighting the cough you had, but managed to give us a really living picture about David Hill. And Vaughan, we're so grateful to you. The questions make it obvious that he's really seeped into our psyche, and there's nobody better. Oh, and now David's going to embarrass me. Oh. I've been translating away. Well, it was a pleasure, and we thank you as well, the audience, for coming. And Santa Claus will be very pleased to donate this book, so by all means, buy a copy. Thank you for coming. No stop.